Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hi, welcome to episode 93 of Write Club the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I do hope this October weather is being kind to you and that you're all busy reading and writing. I'm Heather and I'm in the chair today. We're two down this week and next week, and I'm joined here in our recording space by Teresa, Linda and Pat.
Hi!
With the wonders of the 21st century, Nicola will be dropping in later. This week, Pat will be asking us to name the novel, Teresa will be reading her work in progress, Linda will be telling us all about opening lines, and later on we'll be talking about writing song lyrics. But Nicola and Anne Zaraudi will be telling us what's on their bedside table. Now over to Pat.
Name the novel.
I think you might get this one quite easily. It's an American novel and it won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, the judges of which praised it as a book that stimulates the mind and touches the heart. Amazon selected the novel as the 2013 Best Book of the Year. It was shortlisted for the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. And it was awarded the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction for 2014. There were rave reviews, including one in the Daily New York Times, another in the Sunday New York Times book review. And Woody Brown, writing in Art Voice, described it as a marvellous epic tale. The fact that it's 773 pages allows it to be described as epic.
That is epic. It is epic.
But it wasn't universally admired. Its tone, language and story belong in children's literature, wrote critic James Wood in The New Yorker. He found a book stuffed with relentless, far-fetched plotting, cloying stock characters and an overwrought message tacked on at the end as a plea for seriousness. The London Review of Books likened it to a children's book for adults. And the Sunday Times concluded that no amount of straining for high-flown uplift can disguise the fact that the book is a turkey.
Interesting.
Okay, so
it won some woman's prize or something?
The Women's Prize for Fiction and the Carnegie
Medal. Pulitzer.
So,
it's 773 pages.
And that was recent, 2014.
So it's...
Man, it's a big book.
Divided into a big book.
Okay.
It's described as a coming-of-age tale told in the first person. The Guardian says if there's any one novel that this strand of the story calls to mind, it's Great Expectations. And The Telegraph calls it a Bildungsroman along the lines of Great Expectations with similar gothic multi-layering, eccentric guardians and unrequited love.
I've got an inkling. I think it might be a book I liked very much, actually, but I thought it was came out earlier than that, but I might be wrong.
There's
it's
a second
American.
Strand
oh, it's
to
American,
the novel.
Though.
It's American. I want to get it.
There's a second strand to the novel. Again, according to The Guardian, this one with echoes of Crime and Punishment. And it's a story of betrayal, suspicion, double-dealing and shootouts. And Raymond Chandler is no less a presence here than Dickens and Dostoevsky. To give you a little bit more there, it's the central character starts off as a young boy who loses his mother in dramatic circumstances. Circumstances which create a chain of events which see him move from New York to Las Vegas to Amsterdam and finally back to New York over a period of about 8 to 9 years.
Yeah, I think that...
Teresa's looking...
Yeah, I know, but 774 pages is really throwing me here. I can't...
Teresa's looking very smug.
Yeah.
I think she's got it. But the final clue, and it's a very short and very simple one, and I think this will clinch it for those of you that have an inkling already... The film of the novel has very, very recently been released.
Yeah. Okay. So, I was way off beam with when you were comparing it to Great Expectations and such a big book and so complex. And I thought, is it The Quincunx by Anthony Palliser, I think, which is a sort of It's not a Victorian novel. It's written in the style of a Victorian novel. And
I heard you mention it.
But then when you said the New York to Las Vegas, then it's obviously The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. I'm very, very surprised at some of those criticisms. Yeah. You know, I mean, my opinion is only my opinion, but, I think it's a wonderful book.
Yeah, and very I really well enjoyed written, it.
And I didn't find it childish at all.
I haven't read it, but I keep seeing it pop up everywhere I go online. And so
well, at the moment, you will do because of the film.
It's just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, end of September.
Well, what is its theme? Well, never mind. Cut that.
Well, you can't say too much because we would love people to read it and enjoy it. But it's, you know, the Goldfinch, which you'll see on the cover, is actually a Dutch painting.
Oh, okay.
And while he's with his mother, the boy is with his mother in the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Mm-hmm.
As they're looking at the painting, I think it's his mother's favourite painting, a bomb goes off.
Oh!
And his mother is killed. And that sort of starts the whole process. The beginning.
And that actual scene is brilliantly written.
Amazingly well written.
I would suggest, even if you just read the opening.
Yeah. It sticks in the mind.
As a writer, you will learn from it.
Okay. Right.
You have to look on Amazon for my Kindle.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Now, Teresa is going to read from her work in progress.
Yes, thank you. So those of you who've been following the podcast will remember now that Ronella has continued on her journey without Kez, who is injured, he's resting behind, and we'll catch up with her later. Those of you who haven't listened before, this is a dystopian children's novel that I'm working through. Ronella thought she saw something over to her left. In an instant, she was crouched with an arrow knocked, scanning the bushes. She heard a rustle to her right and turned sharply. A big brown snake was whipping away from her. She smiled in relief and let her bow arm relax. She felt something hit the back of her head and stumbled forward, her arrow dropping uselessly to the ground as her body flattened her bow to the ground. Someone jumped on her and grabbed her arms from behind. She heard several voices shouting, "Pin her down! Pass the rope! Where did she come from?" Ronella struggled to free herself. But from the number of voices and the legs she could see in front of her, she knew she was outnumbered. As she scuffled, she thought that at least Kez would see that the plants were crushed and the dirt disturbed. He would know that she'd been captured and would find her, she hoped. That is, if these kids didn't kill her. Her hands tied, she was dragged to a sitting position and could get a better look at her attackers. They were children, but 2 or 3 years older than her. And tough. They looked really tough. Like they'd fought wars every day. There were 2 girls and 2 boys. They were all dressed the same, in short-sleeved black shirts, with a red shield embroidered on the pocket, and leather shorts. Although she'd never seen one before, Ronella had read enough books to know that this was some sort of uniform. Maybe they all went to the same school, or were some kind of soldiers. "Well, look what Dan caught," said a girl with red curly hair. She seemed to be in charge. "Looks like a savage from the other side of the mountain," Dan grinned. He was a skinny, long-limbed boy with floppy hair. The other girl had sturdy limbs and short blonde curls. "The question is," she said, "what are we supposed to do with her?" Bella, the second boy, who had dark hair and green eyes, was looking at the boss girl. "I think we should hand her over to the generals," Dan said. "Drive her back over the mountains," this was sturdy girl. "Any better ideas, Kirk?" Bella was talking to the green-eyed boy. "I think Carrie's right. Drive her away." Bella looked like she was pretending to think. "What do you think the generals would do with her?" "They'd send her to a slave camp," Dan said. "They would if she didn't resist," said Kirk, "but if she fought them, they'd execute her." Ronella was thinking as hard and as fast as she could. Should she tell them about Larkin? Maybe they would help her to find her. They at least knew the city and how things were organised. Or should she act dumb and watch for a chance to escape? "What's your name and what are you doing here?" Bella sat down in front of Ronella and the other 3 sat down too. "My name's Ronella. I don't really know where I am or how I got here. I was up in the mountains with the goats and one got lost. I was following its tracks. Then it got dark and I hid in a cave. Maybe you can help me find my way home." Shifting her position, Ronella was secretly trying to draw a snake with her heel. Well, I'm Bella, and we're the Lucky Reds, the best hunting gang in Mavropoli. Kirk, untie her and let's have something to eat. Kirk reached round the back of Ronella and untied the rope. As he sat back down and started to coil the rope, Ronella smothered a gasp. He had tattoos on his arm. She saw the lion and the star, just like hers, and the leaf for Chestnut Village. Kirk was Cousin Tolly.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. I'm really impressed with the way you're building tension here and setting everything up with her finding Tolly. And it sounded to me like the others weren't all that hostile after she gave her name and her reason for being there. I really enjoyed it. I loved that chapter. And now I'm very eager to find out more.
I think I did have some comments sent in from Nicola, and she said they untie her too quickly. And I think I agree, and I need to work on it. But it is a first draft, and it was
mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that was my only criticism, was that I felt that the gang became unthreatening.
Yeah, very
rather
quickly.
Too suddenly, and you sort of thinking, why?
Yeah.
Really.
I think I was compressing it a little bit because I wanted a sort of 500 to 600 right chunk for the podcast. I think that's probably why I should have expanded that more.
Can I just check, as I may have missed a bit, have we heard about Cousin Tolly before then?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Right. I remember him in the beginning when they were talking about how these people had captured children, and that's what happened to Uncle
Yeah. If you haven't had it every chapter, but it's sorry. Her, it's her cousin, and
But no, it's a really engaging read. You just want to keep on reading it.
Yeah.
And I thought what was one particularly good feature was the way you handled the conversation between them, the four.
Right.
Because it's not easy. Not always easy when characters are unnamed.
Mm.
And
yes,
it can get very repetitive.
It's quite difficult to introduce four new characters and give them an identity.
Yeah.
And also you don't want to do the thing too much that Stephanie always says in real life, we don't say use people's names.
No,
right.
Like, what do you think, you know,
particular bugbear.
So I did a little bit of that. I had to put the names in somewhere in the dialogue, but I hope I didn't overdo it. I was aware of it anyway.
No, it was fine. Yeah, because you did, like with I think Carrie's right, so now we know that she's called Carrie without it being clunky. A couple of things I picked up on as well, though, particularly at the beginning. I thought you've got this sort of short sentences in that first paragraph to sort of create the tension, and then as she sees the snake, she relaxes, smiled in relief and let her bow arm relax. But then she felt something hit the back of her head, and I just felt that the rhythm of the sentence, if you like, needed to keep on a sort of a downward thing. So she smiled in relief and let her bow arm relax. As she did, she felt.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? Because it comes across as too.
Yeah. Okay. I certainly feel it's not a great transition. So, any help and advice there. And I wondered whether I should have said something about the snake, like, oh, it was just a rat catcher.
Mm.
You know, the big brown ones that nobody's scared of.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
that's a good idea.
Because to make that clear why she's not worried about the snake.
Yes. And I think you noticed as you were reading, didn't you, the sort of to the ground.
Yes.
Some repetitions and some misspellings and things. Yeah.
Yeah, flattened her bow beneath.
Yeah.
When you read it, it didn't stand out to me. But when I read it myself, where you've said kids, that is if these kids didn't kill her.
Mm.
And then the next bit, that they were children.
Yeah.
And at first I thought, did we know they were kids before? Or but when you read it out, it made sense.
Yeah.
I think
it was when I read it that I thought, that just jarred.
I'm not sure about that because she can see their legs and she's kind of aware they're not adults.
Yeah.
I'll change that.
When you hear them saying pin her down, you don't know. You think they're adults, don't you?
Yeah.
I wasn't sure about scuffled.
Yeah.
Because scuffle suggests a sort of wrestling sort of thing.
Mm.
And she wasn't sort of wrestling with them. She was struggling.
Yes.
I know you've already used struggle.
So I need a different word there.
Yeah, I thought so.
I've been so waiting for Tolly. and the tattoos. I've been waiting for that to come into it.
So I did write a little bit more, which isn't in here, but she's trying to with her eyes. She's looking at him and looking at her arm and trying to make him recognise, because she's not sure if it's safe to say anything in front of the other children. And there's a lot of details I need to work out about, like, do they have tattoos? And are they from different places? Yeah. Or if they came from somewhere, not the Morea, not Ranella's land, would their parents have some other system for recognising their children?
It was just great. As soon as I started to read it, I thought, this is where he's going to come into.
Did you know?
Yes.
You guessed it. Oh, that's good.
It was really good.
Now that someone's mentioned it, I think, I did wonder about the snake. She was relieved. And if I saw a snake,
you wouldn't be.
I would not be relieved. But I guess Ranella is more accustomed to
She knows snakes. What's dangerous and what's not. But I need to. I'll just put a little thing in.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a big brown rat catcher.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
Little bit of grammar.
Ooh, yes. Oh, boy. Good, good, good.
Think. Right. Her hands tied. She was dragged to a sitting position.
Mm.
Okay, it's one. We did a thing a while back about starting with a prepositional phrase or that kind of thing. And so her hands tied, yes, you have to follow, then your main clause has to be the same subject. It has to be her.
Yeah.
But she was dragged to a sitting position. Because it's a passive construction, I'm not sure it works.
Okay.
Yeah. It jarred.
Okay.
And I thought her hands were tied.
And she was.
And she was dragged.
Yeah. I can see that sounds better. Yeah. And I do have that. They still slip into passive voice quite often, don't they?
Yeah. I don't think that's.
Yeah. Her hands were tied and she was dragged. So I was probably just hastily writing.
Yeah.
Mm. Thank you.
But other than that, it was good.
Somehow.
I tell you what, with my teacher hat on, I suppose, I could imagine reading that with kids.
Uh-huh.
Well, the whole thing. And it being really engaging and the kids being really into it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
It's good.
Yes. Thank you
very
much.
Assuming that, you know, you can still read in schools these days.
Okay, well, after that comment, we'll move swiftly on and go to Linda, who's going to tell us about opening lines.
Yes, I am. And I find some of these quite amusing. In fact, that's their purpose. This is from the Bulwer Lytton Fiction Contest website, where they say the logo says that the www in that address means wretched writers welcome. And the challenge that they offer to writers is to compose an opening sentence to the worst of all possible novels, sponsored every year by the San Jose State University. And the grand prize is a pittance. And I chose these lines from different years. I went through several years and just chose some that I particularly enjoyed. So actually the 2019 prize was awarded in August this year. And some of these, they rank them with winner and then the runner-up sometimes. And then the, what do they call them? The dishonorable mentions.
Yes.
would be after the second than they do. Okay. Here's the first one, and it was published in 2004, sent in by Corey Gano from Camas, Washington. As he entered the room within which so many a wild night of their sweltering love affair had been spent, the white rabbit regarded her with benevolent eyes, her posture such that he suspected something was wrong. But before he could speak, Alice unburied her face from her trembling hands, and between her intense sobs, he made out the words, "I'm late, I'm late." For Alice in Wonderland, of course. This is from a section called Purple Prose, a dishonorable mention. Again, it was sent in by Jenny Mayfield, St. Louis, Michigan, I guess. The fall leaf, resplendent in red, gold, and purple, fluttered gently to the ground in front of her, and she knew that winter was on fall's heels, soup simmering gently in the crock pot, the snowy night sky reflecting city lights in a color vaguely reminiscent of Donald Trump's hair, while gently falling snow muffled city sounds like a gag on a narcissist. These are so very clever, I think. Here's a runner-up to the detective category. This, again, 2004. The knife handle jutted from her chest like one of the plastic pop-up timers in a frozen turkey. But from the blood pooling around the wound, it was apparent that this bird wasn't done. I love that comparison.
I've never heard the pop-up timer on a frozen turkey. Oh, right. Well, they do. American thing.
Yeah, they do have them in the turkey's breast when you put it in. There's a little plastic thing that sticks inside, and then when the turkey is all done, it pops up to let you know.
That's clever.
This is quite useful, though.
Yes. Yeah, it is. And this is for the winner for crime in 2011. Wearily approaching the murder scene of Jeannie and Quentin Rose and needing to determine if this was the handiwork of the scented strangler who had a twisted affinity for spraying his victims with his signature raspberry cologne or that of a copycat, burnout insomniac detective Sonny Kirkland was sure of one thing. You'd have to stop and smell the roses. Purple Prose, dishonorable mention, 2018. He was a bold man, thought Ariel Calibri, the typesetter's daughter. But he wouldn't...
Oh, that classic.
But he wouldn't recognize a superscript if it was underlined. Believed that strike-through was a baseball term, thought italics were people from Italy, and that sans serif was a Caribbean island.
Yeah, that's clever.
Yeah. Of course, these are not from real novels.
No, but Ariel Calibri is quite a good
name. Isn't that lovely? Yeah. I like that. Ariel Calibri. Crime Detective, dishonorable mention, 2018. For rookie detective Lara Stinson, the hardest aspect of her most recent case was not discovering that the adolescent victim had been thrown from the 10th story of the apartment building by his own grandmother, but rather trying to spell defenestration by octogenarian in her subsequent report.
I like it.
It's good.
There was a word, defenestration, in
Prague.
In a book I read recently, and I didn't know what it meant. It was someone being thrown out a window.
From the Latin fenestra.
Oh, bless your heart.
It's one of the first words I can remember learning in Latin.
Science fiction winner, 2019. The frequent and robust bouts of coupling that young Liam shared with his robot girlfriend, Esther 4.0, while satisfying, often reminded him of eating chocolate-covered cherries without removing the foil wrap.
Yeah, pretty awful.
And the last one here, Crime Detective, a winner for 2019. Realizing that his symptoms indicated a virtually undetectable, fast-acting neurotoxin, CIA coroner Quinn Abner frantically wrote up the details, lay on the floor, and as a professional courtesy, did his best to draw a chalk outline of himself. Oh, I've missed crediting some of these, I think. That one was from Jeremy Dust. Loughborough, England?
Loughborough.
Okay, that was from Jeremy Duss, Loughborough, England.
We'll put the website link.
Okay. I enjoyed these tremendously, and I spent a lot of time going through a lot of years looking at them.
So are you going to enter?
Am I going to enter? Well, I'll look through my materials that I have not finished over the years and see if I have a horrible enough first line.
I'm sure you don't.
Even get a dishonorable
never.
Mention.
Never.
I'm sure you don't.
Very funny.
Well, thank you very much, Linda. That was good. Okay. Well, we decided for this week that we were going to talk about song lyrics. and I sat down at my computer, as I always do. And instead of asking my friend Google, other search engines are available, I sat staring into space and remembered my best friend and I learning all the words to new songs and even buying a weekly magazine so that we were word perfect with all the latest releases. So 50 or so years later, I hear the music and I remember all the words. I can't remember why I'd gone upstairs to get something, but I can remember song lyrics from 50 years ago, which is amazing.
Right.
The opening notes to The Drifters Under the Boardwalk takes me back to the early 60s. I'm sure that's not what we meant when we said when we chose this as a topic. But before I searched for help and advice on how to write song lyrics, I drifted off again, thinking about song lyrics that have appealed to me. Motown was big for me as a teenager, and anything that talked about first love or first kiss or rejection would have me weeping into my Laura Ashley hanky. Glorious days of hormones and spots. For me, the great lyricists are Dylan, Lennon and McCartney. My English teacher at school got us to listen to Eleanor Rigby and then write what we would imagine a life was like. Thank you, Miss Waters. I think she opened my imagination all those years ago. My thoughts are that most of the works by these artists are just poetry to music. I don't know why I've said just. Stevie Wonder, Elton John and Bernie Taupin created songs that are aimed at me and my life. But I don't live in the past, and Ed Sheeran moves me with his words. And don't get me started on Lewis Capaldi's Someone You Loved. I had to resort to the tissues just thinking about the songs. Gone are the Laura Ashley Hankies now in this disposable age. Well, that's a subject for another day. I found a number of websites that guide you through the process of writing songs, starting with ideas. We'll post the links for the ones we found, but I'm sure there are plenty more out there. One of them appealed to me, thesongtrust.com. 5 ways to write the perfect love song. And it says that there are many reasons why you'd want to write a love song, if that's what appeals to you. You may be newly in love, want to tell that special someone how you feel. Maybe you've been in love for some time, but you've not said it enough. Or maybe you're just fascinated by the concept of love and want to explore what makes it so unique. Or maybe you just spent the best part of an hour listening to Ed Sheeran and Lewis Capaldi. Whatever reason, a well-written love song is one that can have a timeless effect on your listeners and is something that most, if not all, of the great songwriters of all time have tried to achieve. And the website goes on to say 5 ways to achieve it. Show your passion. And I think most of these, if not all of these, if you just want to write any song, it doesn't have to be about love. The best way to create the effect of a love song is to simply let your passion shine through. The complexity of the music and message should match. The focus of love songs is the message, not the composition. While you obviously don't want the music to be boring, you also want to make sure that the finished product puts your love in the clear spotlight. The idea to make sure the complexity of the music should match that of the lyrics and the message. If your love song is a simple thing, try and make the music simple, using something like an acoustic guitar or just a piano. If your love is over the top, you may want to include strings or an arrangement of music that complements just how complex your love truly is.
Something I read, Heather, very much suggested: start with simple chords, keep it simple when you're at the actual composition writing stage.
Yeah.
And you can add layers and you know, trumpets and, and violins or whatever later on.
Yeah.
But that was just a tip for writing.
I won't read the rest of it word for word, but it talks about the fact that everyone's definition of love is different. So we're not all going to think the same romantic thoughts about it. Avoid cliches. And it mentions love is in the air or love is blind. Mm-hmm. It's been used. It's old.
It's the moon in June.
Yes, that's right. And it needs a hook. So whatever you're writing needs a hook to remind you.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, you know, the things I found, and a little bit about listening to soppy music on the radio.
Yeah. I was thinking about some of the songs I grew up with and the music that my parents listened to, and they speak in many cases of a more complex kind of love, not first love. And I think for my parents' generation, divorce was not something that happened within their circle. And you think about songs like Please Release Me, Set Me Free, or Don't Sleep in the Subway, Darling. And they're about marriages that are troubled, difficult, and people who are trapped in relationships.
Right.
And I think now the songwriting has changed because society has changed and culture has changed and people are singing about different forms of love, different experiences.
Well, the Lewis Capaldi song that I particularly like, the video shows somebody who's died. Peter Capaldi, who played Doctor Who on the television, he's the character in the video. And it's actually round where I live, where they did the video. Yeah. And that's, you know, I suppose kind of quite a new subject for songs, that you'll actually touch on death and dying.
Shakespeare's
and,
right. sister did Stay With Me, I think it was called. And, yeah, it does, you know, I suppose the Cat Stevens possibly not one of his greatest songs, but My Lady Darbanville.
Yes.
Which is, she wasn't actually dead, but he was imagining, because his love was dead, he imagined her as a dead.
Well, again, that takes me back, and I could probably sing it if I sing.
Yes. Well, it reminds me, when you're talking about death, of, gosh, I'm so old, I don't remember what century this came out, but Teen Angel, does anybody hear that one, where they got stuck on the railroad tracks, and he couldn't get her out of the car in time? And he's so bereft, he's just screaming his head off for
years. There's quite a few. Yes, there are late 50s, early 60s. Johnny, Remember Me, Leader of the Pack.
Oh, yeah. Pack,
I suppose that's true, and I've not thought about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then also, being from the South in the United States and living in Tennessee for a long time, Nashville, of course, is big in my mind. And the songs there are generally about broken hearts and love gone wrong, and so many of them. But there are also some that are just really hilarious about it. Like this guy who's, you know, going fishing all the time, and his wife complains and says, you know, it's either me or the fishing, and so he goes off fishing and sings, I'm sure gonna miss her.
But again, the Nashville and the country music has changed, hasn't it? Because I mean, sort of 20 years ago, we had this sort of feminist country song coming through, I Feel Like a Woman Tonight, and
Tammy Wynette, you know,
who's always had that edge to her, and it's a great songwriter, actually.
Loretta Lynn, Loretta Lynn was wonderful, because when things started changing a lot, I remember she wrote the song about, Now I've Got the Pill, and basically it's about, you've been out running around on me, now I got the pill.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. My brother is a songwriter, actually, and he has talked about these websites and other books and things that are supposed to help you. He doesn't like to use them because he thinks everything should just come right from the heart. And
but that dilemma, or that duality, if you like, applies to all writing. There are still an awful lot of people who say you can't be taught writing.
Right.
You've either got the talent or you haven't. Uh-huh. I personally know that I can be taught, and I can learn craft, technique, from other people. Yeah. So I don't have an issue with that, but I understand that.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know, making a cake. You need the ingredients, but you need to know the right techniques to put those ingredients together,
right,
and get the good results out of it.
Absolutely,
I was amazed when I saw all the advice and guidance that there is available. I mean, I found that I thought was really good. Somebody called Robin Frederick, female, and didn't know the name, and I think it's a link worth putting. On the page, and she sort of takes you through the whole process, how to get started, talk about the lyrics and how to build the song, how to structure it, and then she goes on to talk about the musical side, though not in great depth. And that's one of the problems. I think of song lyrics. I can remember teaching and using song lyrics as a way into poetry for And to me, that's basically what song lyrics are. They're poetry, but they follow certain rules.
Yes, as regards the structure. I think you can get away with more when you're putting words to music, because you change things around to fit the rhythm, the scansion, which just on a page. It wouldn't necessarily get away with it. But it is an interesting discussion, you know, and I found an interesting article by Matthew Zapruder in the Boston Review, discussing the difference between poetry and song lyrics. And he obviously thinks there's a lot of snobbery, you know, that's his point of view. And he says, it seems absurd to me to contend that lyrics inherently have less literary merit than poetry,
right,
or are easier to create, or are less valuable in a cultural or human sense, and therefore somehow do not deserve the rarefied title of poetry.
Right. I think there's a lot of Bob Dylan's work that actually is so poetic, and I think that could be... Then also there are so many poems that have been made into song. Remember Richard Corey? Who recorded that? Richard Corey. It's the Beatles. Simon and Garfunkel. Okay. And that's a poem that was taken from the poem. And please forgive me, I can't remember the poet's name.
Who we can wrote look Richard it up.
Corey? Doesn't ring any bells, do, yeah. I thought I knew most of Paul Simon.
There are others, but I can't think of it.
Yeah, no, but poems get set to music and lyrics can be separated out and read as poetry.
Right.
But, you know, obviously by choosing to write a song, you're adding another dimension with the music, aren't you, which can reinforce.
And to some extent, the sort of genre of the song does impact on the type of lyrics that you're going and how poetic.
Right.
I think if you're doing bluesy, folky stuff, I think that may be, in a lot of instances, more similar to poetry than something more sort of pop, which tends to be more sort of versified. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't know if you agree with that.
I mentioned Elton John and Bernie Taupin, and they, from what I've read, they sort of have different roles.
Yes.
And Tim Rice and whoever.
Andrew Lloyd.
One would write the music.
So Bernie Taupin was the lyricist.
Yes.
Tim Rice in the other partnership.
Yes.
But some, as I think Lennon McCartney, it was a more organic working together.
Mm. Right. The mood is set too by the music, whatever the music is. It really helps to set the mood.
I have to say, the article I read, which I thought was really good, until she started to talk about creating melody and finding the chords and so on. And then even though she says, you know, if you're not a musician, then she even talks about ways that you could find a musician to sort of to work with. And that's where she kind of started to lose me a little bit, because I'm just not very musical personally. And I thought,
has anybody here written a song?
No.
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 I don't think so.
Never even thought or tried to do it at all.
Oh, thinking about it, yeah. Little bits of things, usually sort of parody type ones, when I've done school shows.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
But nothing very
significant. Oh, now you say that, yes. When we did a show for the Edinburgh Fringe, we rewrote, so we used the music of Teddy Bear's Picnic and different things and rewrote the lyrics. I've forgotten about that. But what I was thinking about, I did write a song a few years ago called Stay Away from Dr. Gimp. Because I'm not a musician, I can't think of a tune. Mm. And so it goes to the tune of Reasons to be Cheerful, and it's always, I imagine, Ian Dury singing it. So, I think if you're a musician as well, then writing songs would be a natural thing to do. But if you're not a musician, you do need to find someone to help you realise the song, don't you?
My brother says my brother has a rather large property, and it has to be mowed a lot. He's very particular about keeping it all mowed. And so he rides around on his lawnmower, and he tells me that that's where he really composes a lot, because he's riding on the mower. He can't listen to anything. He can't read anything. He can't do anything else. And he thinks, and the songs just come. In fact, one of his most popular songs came to him pretty much, not whole, but over a few days of riding on the mower. Mm-hmm. And it was about, it's about the Vietnam era, because he was in the army during that time. And it's been an extremely popular song, not on the radio. It is in Australia, but not getting on the radio much in the States. However, he's invited every year to Vietnam memorials to sing his song.
Wow.
And he goes to Florida and other states where he's invited by the Vietnam Veterans.
Wow.
Society.
So does he perform, or does he other artists perform?
He performs it. He sings it himself. Wow. And I think that that has to be because he has so much feeling in it from himself. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it would be the same with another artist.
Yeah. I mean, I think the singer-songwriter thing, very often, you know, it comes from that passion or feeling very strongly about something. But then again, we do see these songs covered by other artists as time goes by. I mean, Leonard Cohen songs, Bob Dylan songs have been covered by other artists, as have Cat Stevens songs. So it's maybe we'll to reinvest them with a different feeling as well.
Maybe we can include a link to his song on the line.
Yeah, that would be great if you email that to me.
I will do that.
And maybe if there's a songwriter out there who writes their own music, if they want to get in touch and come and talk to us.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That would be absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. It would be.
Contact us via the Facebook group. And
that would be good. Okay, well, thanks for that. We're almost at the end, but first, Nicola and Anzarudi are going to tell us what's on their bedside table.
I'm still working my way through the John Connolly books. I'm currently on The Black Angel, which is another Charlie Parker mystery. But in between, because that was on my Kindle, and I like to take a break from that sometimes. So in between, I've read a great book called Vanish by Tess Gerritsen, Gerritsen, and it's described as a Risley and Isles thriller. Now, Risley is a female detective and Isles is a female pathologist, and they sort of work as a team. So this one was good. It was The Beautiful Woman Appears to Be Just Another Corpse in the Morgue, but when Dr. Maura Isles looks down at the body, she gets the fright of her life. The corpse opens its eyes. Now very much alive, the woman is rushed to hospital where she murders a security guard and seizes hostages, one of whom is the heavily pregnant detective Jane Rizzoli. But who is this woman? What does she want? Only Jane can solve the mystery if she survives the night. It's a really good book and you don't know what's coming next, and I really thoroughly enjoyed it. So if you like police procedural mixed with pathology and a bit of a thriller, then it's done for you.
Anzarudi, what's on your bedside table?
Well, for a change, because I'm usually an avid reader of fiction, on my bedside table at the moment is what you might call an autobiography. And it's called The Salt Path, written by Raina Wynne, Sunday Times bestseller, and I think it was on the Costa Book Awards shortlist. Just days after Raina Wynne learned that Moth, her husband of 32 years, was terminally ill, they lost their home and livelihood. With nothing left and little time, they impulsively decided to walk the 630-mile southwest coast path from Somerset to Dorset via Devon and Cornwall. Living wild and free at the mercy of sea and sky, they discovered a new liberating existence. But what would they find at journey's end? So it's a fantastic book. It's actually a book about homelessness, but homelessness not as we know it. It's about a lovely couple just like us from Wales who lost their lovely Welsh farm and ended up living in a tent down there in the West Country, and how it all works out for them is just a fascinating read, and I'd highly, highly recommend it.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yes, thanks for that. Well, that was Right Club the podcast. Thank you to all of you who take the time to listen to us. Do get in touch and let us know what you're reading or writing. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher or Radio Public so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. Join our Facebook group and just search for Write Club, the podcast. Please leave us a review and tell your friends about us. Bye.
Bye. Bye.